Daniel Lin, and I'm a partner with Marks & Clark in Hong Kong. I'm here to provide you with a presentation regarding Asia and Chinese intellectual property, an introduction, and this is for Esquire CLE in Ohio, USA. Start off a little bit of discussion on Asia. And Asia includes 35 to 40 countries, depending on how you count it, ranging from New Zealand and Australia in the south, all the way up to usually Korea, Japan. From east-west, you're going all the way from either India, Pakistan, and all the way over to Japan and Thailand, Indonesia. Sometimes people consider the South Pacific Islands as well. But it's a very, very large geographic area. Covers, as I mentioned, 35, 40 countries. But also, if you look on page 3 of the presentation, you can see it actually totals about 3.9 billion people. So that's more than half of the world's population is generally regarded to be in Asia. If you look at the 2016 estimates, you're talking about, you know, 1.37 billion in China, 1.27 billion in India. U.S. is about 324 million for comparison. After that, you've got Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, et cetera, et cetera. Like I said, you've got over 3.9 billion people. So it's the fastest growing region of the world when it comes in terms of population, when it comes in terms of income. In the economies, it's got 13 of the 15 fastest growing economies in the entire world. So you're basically talking about an area of the world where if you're not trying to manufacture there, you're definitely going to be wanting to sell there in the next few decades. So it really behooves American companies and attorneys to understand a little bit about the Asian intellectual property regime and a little bit about what you can do, what you can't do, the differences between practicing in Asia as well as U.S. So we're focusing this discussion mostly on, from a U.S. practitioner's perspective, what should you know about Asia, intellectual property in Asia? What should you know as an attorney or as a patent attorney or a trademark attorney or lawyer whose clients are going to be active in Asia? Okay. It's by no means comprehensive. It's only an introduction. But at least it'll get you thinking a little bit about the differences, and it'll help you understand a little bit at least what questions to be asking when it comes to IP in Asia. Okay. Turning to slide 4, I'll explain a little bit about going through the agenda here. We'll start off with, who is this guy? Who's this strange person talking on the phone to you? What is an IP toolkit? A little bit about Asia IP introductions and some suggestions for what you can do with Asia IP and what you can't do. People are always interested in anti-counterfeiting, so we'll hit on that a little bit. And I'll talk about some China-specific items, which people always have questions about. Turning to slide 5, I ask you, who is this guy? So, my name is Michael Lin. I'm at ABC, which is an American-born Chinese. I grew up pretty much all over the U.S., was born in the North, grew up in the Midwest, and then went to California, Berkeley for undergraduate, studied biochemistry out there. Was really a terrible, terrible scientist, as I learned when I worked in industry after I graduated. So I worked in the Bay Area for a couple of years and realized I just couldn't handle the wet chemistry. Great on the theory, but really bad at the practice. So I ended up saying, forget it, I don't need a PhD in genetics. Ended up going to Boston University Law School on the East Coast for law school, basically to become a patent attorney. So I started off my career as a patent attorney with Procter & Gamble in Japan. I was there for 10 years, and I was also a Procter & Gamble patent attorney in China for about 3.5 years. During that time, I was doing Asia-wide intellectual property, specifically patents, ranging from, you know, as I said, India all the way to Japan, and then from Korea all the way down to Australia and New Zealand. About 2010, I ended up quitting P&G and joining Marks & Clark in Hong Kong. and I've been the life sciences chemistry head for China and Hong Kong for the past 6 years, and it's been great. I get to really handle a lot of different interesting cases, but also help out a lot of people. And one thing that's to be clear on, I'm not a Chinese or Japanese patent attorney, but I am an American patent attorney who has been around in Asia for a long time and just picked up a lot of stuff. So, okay. Turning to page 6, I think this is something which most intellectual property attorneys know, but for those of you who are not, quick rundown on what's your typical IP toolkit. These are the tools that you have in order to be able to protect intellectual property pretty much the same around the world. It's the same general categories. They may change the name a little bit. In Asia, you don't usually call them utility patents. You just call them patents. There are utility models, which are separate from utility patents. Or some people call them standard patents. Just depends on the terminology. Designs, could be industrial designs. You know, a couple different names for that. Trademarks are pretty much trademarks. Trade dress may or may not exist, depending on what country you're talking about. Copyright pretty much exists everywhere, and trade secrets pretty much exist everywhere, although the details vary a lot by country to country. So as most people would know, patents and utility models tend to protect technical functions, technical inventions, the way you do something, how you make it, the machine or device which does it, and the method of doing something. That is pretty much universal. I think some of the differences between Asia and the U.S. we'll go into a little bit later on. But it's basically a means to achieve a function, the packages, the implements, the devices, the formulas, the processes, uses and methods of doing things, combinations of the above. And we will talk about utility models later on. Duration is basically 20, 21 years, depending on if you've got a priority document, a U.S. provision, something like that. Designs, basically, designs are kind of the package or product appearance, the 3D shape of something, containers, golf clubs, could be labeling, it could be actually fabrics designs and things like that, depending on the country. In design patents, you tend to have a very large variation in how long they'll last. Could be 10, 20, 15 years, sometimes 25 years, depending on the country that you're talking about. Trademarks, trade dress, differences, they really must be distinctive, and they're really to identify the origin. Who's selling something? Who's making something? Where is it coming from? Where is that product coming from? People, of course, know these as brand names, logos, colors, smells. Sometimes it's known as the actual, the color, could be actually the colors itself. In Procter & Gamble, we had Gillette, and part of their portfolio was the Duracell brand. Duracell actually has, in many countries, the copper color plus the black in batteries. And so, John Deere has yellow plus green, right? You can get these basic color combinations as part of your brand or as part of your trademark. In some places, you can also do 3D trademarks, which are great for if you have on the internet, your product revolving or turning around on the internet in your web page or something like that. But then in some countries, you can also do trade dress, which protects basically the get up and the color combination, the style of something. But that's going to really vary from country to country. So you really need to talk to someone who understands the local law if you're going to be relying on trade dress. But the great thing about trade dress and trademarks is that if you continue to use them, your protection could last literally forever. Moving moving on to copyrights, in order for a copyright to exist, it must be original, must be something that you've come up with, typically covering artistic works. Usually it's sometimes the artwork on the label, print, TV, radio copy, internet pictures, artworks such as sculptures, paintings, things like that. Commercially, it could also cover things like product and container shapes, arrangements, things like that. You do have to be careful a little bit about copyright. In some countries, you are not allowed to get copyright if you make more than 50 or 500 of the items. If you make more than that, it's not considered copyrightable. It's more considered to be industrial design or something like that. But the copyright laws in the world tend to protect the copyright for life of the author plus 50 or 75 years, depending on the country. There are also variations in for, you know, publication, for compositions and things like that. But that does vary quite a bit. But the good thing about copyright is that in many places you automatically have it upon creation. Once you fixed whatever your song, poem, or painting, or whatever, once you fixed it in either writing or video or recording or something like that, you automatically gain your copyright, which is really wonderful because you don't actually have to pay anything to register. Oftentimes you can register it, but that is something which is more of an optional thing. Highly recommended if you're planning on trying to enforce your copyright. Again, that varies from country to country. So again, seek some local advice if you're thinking about doing that. Trade secrets. Trade secrets have a huge variation across Asia. In some places, it's treated very, very much like it is in the U.S., you know, you've actually attempted to protect it. You've labeled it. It is a secret that no one else knows or is not commonly known outside. It has some type of commercial value. It can be considered a trade secret. In other countries, it's much more restrictive. And so, again, that's something which you would probably need to discuss with a local attorney if you're trying to, you know, discuss something about maybe trademark theft or trade secret theft or something like that. Oftentimes, trade secrets can be protected via employment contracts or other types of contracts which you would have with the individuals. But in most places, you do need to make an effort to keep it secret, to mark it as a secret, to mark it as proprietary or whatever. But that's something which, again, you'll need to really check with a local attorney. But anyways, it could be anything that has value to the business. It could be technical information, business information, contracts, HR procedures, you know, whatever. But it could be a lot of different things. It could be the way your telephone, internal telephone list, extension list, because you don't want random people starting to call up the people in your business or in your office and starting to headhunt them, or to try to get, different types of information from them, or, you know, bother them and waste your time. So again, I know certain companies that consider their internal telephone list to be trade secrets. Organizational charts could be considered trade secrets. Could also be, you know, of course, technical specs and things like that, manufacturing specs, manufacturing processes and details like that as well. Okay, moving on to page 7, we've got a little bit of an introduction to patents specifically in Asia. In Asia, it's not enough for it to be useful. Almost across, well, actually, I would say across the board in Asia, a patent must have some technical benefit. It must be an advance in the technical arts. It must have some technical effect in order to be patentable. So it's not just novelty and non-obviousness. It actually has to have some type of technical effect. Because of that, oftentimes business models, software patents are not patentable subject matter, not statutory subject matter, in Asia. And also, there are quite a lot of limitations on pharmaceuticals, drugs, methods of treatment, methods of diagnosis of diseases. Most times in Asia, those are not patentable subject matter either. That's not because there's no technical effect, but it's more like it is in Europe, where for public policy reasons, people, the legislators have decided that they don't want people getting patents on methods of treating people, methods of ridding the world of disease, but they will allow patents on the drugs that do that, but not on the methods of using it, the methods of treating, the methods of diagnosing. As far as utility models go, we will talk a little bit more about that, because I think that is actually a really big opportunity area for American attorneys to advise their clients on. But usually they're for physical objects only, very few methods, formulas, software, etc. for utility models. But we'll talk a little bit about that later. Increasingly, I'm seeing Western businesses file more and more utility models. And I think, as I'll talk about later, there are quite a few benefits to filing utility models, either in conjunction with patents or instead of patents. Moving on to slide 8, we've got trademarks. Generally, trademarks and all patents as well in Asia tend to be first to file. That used to be something which I'd have to discuss a lot, but now that the U.S. is first to file as well, people are getting pretty much used to that. But almost everywhere in the world now, Europe, Asia, Americas, are first to file, both for trademarks, for patents, for designs, for those types of IP. There are some places in Asia that still have common law trademarks where you can acquire rights through use without any registration whatsoever. And in some countries, under certain situations, those rights that you've acquired through common law trademarks can actually trump registered trademarks, or can be a way to oppose or invalidate registered trademarks. But then again, that's going to vary significantly depending on the country as well. You need to really watch out for things that are internationally versus locally famous. Oftentimes, a lot of my Western clients will assume that because their trademark is well known internationally, that they can oppose someone else's trademark that they filed in the local jurisdiction. Maybe, maybe not. Don't definitely rely on this, because it's going to vary a lot. You have situations like Ferrari, the car. You know, in China, years and years and years ago, there was this place called the Silk Market, which was famous for selling lots of counterfeit goods. When I started going to China in the 1999, 2000, 2003, 2004, it was very, very famous. Everyone would stop by there to get their knockoff goods before they went back to their home countries. Well, the Ferrari, obviously, they've been making cars for many decades, 100 years, and their logo is quite well known. And in China, they had registered their Ferrari mark for cars and car parts. However, there's a person at the Silk Market who started selling leather jackets with the Ferrari logo on it. And there was nothing Ferrari could do because, frankly, they'd never considered registering for clothing and leather goods in China. You know, they ended up fighting for decades on that. And finally, I believe they ended up invalidating the mark by showing, enough international renown. But that was really an iffy case. I mean, like I said, they ended up filing for years on that before they actually finally got a decent result. And actually, they could have lost that one very easily. There's many, many cases of that where trademark squatters have filed trademarks in Russia and China decades or 10 years, 8 years, 5 years before Starbucks decided to come in. And then they had to go through long processes to try to get those back. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. So if you have clients who are actually going to be doing business in Asia, who are going to be either making or selling or importing, exporting their products into, from China, whatever, or most Asian countries, you probably want to have them file the trademarks. Trademarks are relatively cheap. Why wouldn't you file it rather than paying, $1 million in litigation fees later on, or someone holding your trademark for ransom later on and having to pay tens of thousands or $100,000 to get it back. That being said, you need to make sure that whoever your contact is inside a company, or if you're the corporate counsel, make sure that you're talking to the business people so that you understand where your company is going to be going in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, right? And if you think you're going to be heading out to one of these countries where you haven't done business before, spend the money to file a trademark now, right? It's good insurance for the future. But also be very careful, because the trademark classification systems, for example, in China, are different from other places in the world. In many countries, you may just file in one or two classes. In China, you may need to file in four classes or more classes because of the way that the trademark classification works. That being the case, again, a little bit of foresight will serve you well. The penny of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Copyrights, again, basically your copyrights are pretty much automatically vested in you upon creation of a work, of an artistic work. What you need to watch out for a little bit there is, again, if you're making it for commercial reasons, if you're making many replicates of it, then you may run afoul of the limitation on the number of replicates that you can make. And then again, that's going to vary country to country. It could be 50, it could be 100, or it could be no limit. So be very careful about that. Again, if you're going to enforce your copyrights, you might as well spend a couple $100 to register it, get a registered copyright certificate, which will help you a lot in courts. Any court in Asia will look much more favorably upon a registered copyright than just a regular copyright, which hasn't been registered. Trade secrets, again, it's just going to vary a lot country by country. Some countries are very, very strict on what they consider trade secrets and what you need to do to prove it's a trade secret. Other ones, maybe not. It just really depends. But it's good practice. One of the best practices I know is that mark everything. If you think it's confidential, mark it as confidential and proprietary. And don't just mark it in English, mark it in the local language as well. If you're doing business in China, you're sending your proposal or you're sending your CAD program or something like that to someone in China, mark it as confidential. Make sure you use digital watermarking or whatever so that you can prove whether or not someone's been copying it. And mark it in Chinese and mark it in English. Mark, whatever language it is. If you're doing something in Korea or Japan, mark it in Korean and Japanese as well. Same thing in Indonesia or wherever. It just makes sense. It gives them one less excuse to say that, oh, I didn't know it was proprietary. I didn't know it wasn't something I could copy and show to my brother down the street. Okay. Moving on to slide 9. We'll talk a little bit about my suggestions here for opportunity areas, which I think American attorneys can advise their clients on. Design patents. Most people are pretty familiar with design patents. They're quick. They're relatively easy and cheap to file. Usually, they can be enforced pretty easily as well. It's similar to a trademark where you can just show a judge, look, this is my design registration, this is their product, they're almost exactly the same, from any view you look at it, they're the same. Therefore, they're copying my product, and you should, you know, find me. They're pretty much available in every country, so there's no real reason why you wouldn't be able to file a design patent in almost any Asian country. The actual rules on the drawings may vary a bit. Some countries allow photographs, other countries will not. I would be wary about filing design patents with photographs, though, because oftentimes items that are visible in the photograph that you may not think are important will be considered an essential part of the design. So the color or the shading or the shadow or something like that may be something which would then hurt you when you try to enforce it. If I have the time, if my client has the resources, I almost always suggest that they file the design patent with line drawings, not shaded CAD drawings. But again, sometimes it's not possible, and you do your best. Sometimes if your priority document that you're claiming priority from is pictures, some countries will not allow you to replace that with line drawings. You have to file the same pictures or the same CAD drawings or whatever. So again, making sure your priority document is sufficient for whatever country that you're going to extend it to is pretty important. And the great thing about design patents, also very, very little translation, generally are approved relatively quickly, sometimes in a couple of weeks, and other times it may take a year, but that's still much faster than most countries' regular patents or utility models are. Also, the fees are generally pretty low compared to other types of IP, other than trademarks. Another thing which I think American attorneys can really benefit from is the patent prosecution highway. If you are filing a patent in the U.S. or Canada or some other country first in Europe, and then you want to extend that into Asia, most Asian countries will allow you to use the patent prosecution highway and get a very, very fast grant.
Buckeye CLE's first verification code is BEANS, BEANS, BEANS. Buckeye CLE's first verification code is BEANS, BEANS. Please take a moment and write this down.
If you have a corresponding grant somewhere else. So even countries that don't have official patent prosecution highways will simply accept granted claims from somewhere else in their applications and just allow basically rubber stamp the claims if they're translated into the local language. But Japan, Korea, China, where it may be difficult to get claims granted, or you may have other issues going on in those countries, you can oftentimes leverage a U.S. grant to improve your chances of getting something granted in China, Japan, Korea, especially if you file the request before they've done the search in the local country. I think that's usually that's a requirement. You must file the request for the PPH treatment before they've started to examine the actual application. But that being said, you know, I've gotten a patent granted in Australia in 2 weeks. Literally before I received the filing, you know, information, the complete filing information, they sent me, oh, by the way, your patent's granted. Singapore also has, Singapore's patent laws is under flux right now. They've just had some recent changes which have changed the prosecution options for you. But nonetheless, you can leverage the patent prosecution highway. It's great. It speeds things up. Oftentimes, it can reduce the costs for your clients as well. Prosecution costs are lowered. You may have no office actions, or you may have just one or two office actions relating to formalities and things like that. Trademarks, and not just trademarks, but all different types of IP that you can file for. Filing early is better. Asia is pretty much first to file all over for trademarks, patents, designs, utility models. So you really want to file early. We talked a little bit about trademark squatting earlier. I can't even say how many times I've had to deal with situations where clients didn't file first, they delayed on something, or they missed the priority period to 6 months for trademarks and designs. They missed that, and so now they've had to refile or something without claiming priority, and now they've lost it. It's something where a good attorney should be thinking on a worldwide basis nowadays. The U.S. is a very special case because the U.S. is so big and so affluent. However, almost all the, and even SMEs now, they want to file in Asia, right? Because that's where their future expansion is, or they're going to be making it there. You need to really think about what's going to be best for your client in a more proactive manner, and really to get them, remind them, say, yeah, we took care of the U.S., maybe we've done Europe, but where are you going to make it? Okay, if you're making it in the U.S., that's fine. Where's your competitor going to make it? Are they going to make it in China? Are they going to make everything's made in China, right? So it really behooves you to consider this proactively for your clients, right? It'll save them so many headaches later on. Going on to utility models, turn the page to page 10. And utility models, again, we don't have those in the States, so I'm going to spend a little bit of extra time on this. Basically, utility models have been called, junk. They've been called petty patents. They've been called innovation patents instead of invention patents. Some people have called them, pretty much worthless. And I would say in some countries they kind of are worthless, but in other countries they're not. They've been a mainstay of the German and European, many European countries' patent laws for hundreds of years. In Japan and Korea, they're extremely prevalent, and Japanese and Korean companies use them a lot. In China, they're available, and I think there's something which oftentimes get a bad rap, but really, if you're advising your client for certain clients, for certain technologies, for certain products, they're extremely useful. First of all, they're quick and cheap to file. Oftentimes, you may be able to, like in China, you can file for a utility model on the same day that you file for a regular patent, a utility patent in China, and the utility model will be granted anywhere from 3 to 6 to 8 months, and you can use that to tide you over until your actual patent gets granted, which may be 3-4 years in some cases, or 8 years, and then at that time you can decide which one you're going to go forward with, or sometimes you may be able to keep them both going, or maybe you choose one and abandon the other. But certainly, they're not available everywhere. As says on the slide, Brunei, India, Pakistan, Singapore, Sri Lanka are not available. Some countries will have substantive exam. Other ones will have formality exam only. And actually, you can use the PCT to enter certain countries with utility models. But you need to make a special designation at the time you enter the national fix. If you look, there's a separate PDF file which you should have received, and that is an Asia Utility Model Quick Reference Table. That's something which I made a couple of years ago, but it's still up to date. Not much has changed in this respect, but it shows you the different major countries in Asia which have utility models or variations of utility models. In Australia, they're called innovation patents. They used to be called petty patents there. In Indonesia, they're still called petty patents. Hong Kong and Macau call them short-term patents. But there's a lot of different names for them, but they pretty much cover the same thing. Most of them will cover, all of them will cover a device, so a widget that you have, and you can cover those structurally in claims just like any other, like a regular utility patent claim. In the Philippines, you can actually cover anything you can cover a regular patent for. So you can use it for drugs, you can use it for chemical compositions as well. But most of the other countries will not allow you to do that. Novelty in Asia is pretty much absolute. In some cases, there may not be an inventive step. So actually, as long as it's novel, you can get enforceable utility patent for it, which you think, okay, well, that's, you know, is that useful, really? I don't know. But the thing is, if you only have novelty, then it's almost impossible to then go and invalidate that utility model. Specifically in China, the largest patent award ever in China was for a utility model, right? The second largest was for a design patent. So, you know, don't overlook these things. Certainly they can be huge boons to the business when they're used correctly. That being said, you know, you need to really take a look at the differences there, whether it's allowed to go concurrently with a patent or not. In some countries, you're allowed to switch between ones. So if you are having trouble with getting your patent granted because it's obvious and you can't get the inventive step, some countries will allow you to switch from a regular patent to a utility model and then just get it granted. Again, it's something where you need to think a little bit about what the strategy is of your client, what type of product it is, but it may be, you know, a good way for your client to either get something granted that they wouldn't otherwise get granted, or manage to save some money and, you know, while getting equivalent protection. I know that I would say in the past 4 years, now probably longer than that, about 8 years. I've seen a lot more utility models filed for things in the consumer electronics space, simply because the product life cycle in the consumer electronics space is probably 3 years, 4 years maybe. You don't need 20 years protection for most of these things. Instead, you know, if you can get it granted in 3 months or 6 months and it's good for 8 years or 10 years, that's enough. And you don't need to worry about it. Because by the time, you know, your regular patent gets granted, maybe 4 or 5 years after you launch the product, it's already 2 or 3 generations past what you would have gotten your protection for. So instead, a lot of consumer electronics companies are now filing utility models instead of regular utility patents, and they're getting things granted faster. It's covering the business need, and then within a couple of years, they move on to a different type of product, different type of model, a different type of, you know, feature, which, you know, they don't care about. They don't need to spend so much money and time getting the, you know, utility patent granted. They just go for the utility model. Some very, very large companies have noticeably increased their utility model filings in China, as well as other countries in Asia that I've seen. So again, consider it. It's not right for everything. If it's a foundational technology for the next 20 years or 30 years of your company's products, your client's products, you don't want to be filing only a utility model for it. You may use utility model to supplement, but you wouldn't want to only file a utility model for it. But if it's, you know, 5 years of protection or 8 years of protection or 10 years of protection is enough, maybe you want to consider that. And usually if you look on that sheet, the filing fees are usually much lower compared to a regular patent, usually about half. Other times it could be, you know, a tenth of the filing fee. Especially especially in countries like Japan. So anyways, please take a look at that utility model quick reference chart. It's, you know, I've had many people tell me it's extremely useful for them. At the least, it allows you to have a discussion and to initiate a discussion with your clients to help them to understand what their options are, because everyone wants to get patents granted immediately. You know, those of us know who are in the business know it takes a long time. But sometimes a client needs something immediately, and this is a really good way to do it. Again, most times definitely within a year, oftentimes within 3-4 months, sometimes within a couple of weeks, actually. It depends on the country. So consider it. At the end, I have my email address. If you have any questions, please let me know. I mean, I get a lot of questions about YouTube emails. Going on to the slides, page 11, again, consider utility models for products that are easy to copy, relatively low-tech, or have a short market life. In cases where the inventive step is very low, you may want to consider that. It's especially useful for items which have a low manufacturing cost and which are mass producible, because again, you can oftentimes, you know, enforce utility models easier in some cases than you can a regular patent. And again, you know, for products that are important yet low value that you don't want to spend a lot of money on a regular patent for, a utility model is a good option. So again, please consider it. Moving on to slide 12. I think there's a lot of people who, you know, as American attorneys, we spend 3 years learning the law, years in practice, understanding how to, you know, take care of things in our own jurisdiction. We know pretty well that, oh, if you are living in New York and you're an attorney in New York, you go to Massachusetts or D.C. or other places, things are a bit different. But for whatever reason, I see a lot of clients and attorneys who, when they come out to Asia, they expect everything to be exactly the same as what they're doing back home. And I get this from American attorneys, I get this from European attorneys, I get this from, you know, even people, you know, in Japan that sometimes think that the practice in China should be the same as Japan. It's not. Right? Intellectually, we know it, but, you know, emotionally, sometimes we don't get it. So understand your local practice. If you've got a litigation going on, if you've got an enforcement situation going on, if you've got, you know, if you're just, yeah, the filing stage, really try to get the local expertise to help you avoid problems, because oftentimes the things that you assume would normally be okay are not okay, right? Again, litigation is probably the most high-risk thing. Most people, of course, will get local litigation advice if they are going to be litigating in an area they're not familiar with, in a geography they're not familiar with. And I think there's not a lot of people who would just jump into a court case without getting local litigation advice. Nonetheless, there's very, very different, huge differences in practice, right? In some places, attorneys are allowed to talk to a judge where they have a case pending in front of that judge. They're allowed to talk to that judge without the other attorney being present. That would never happen in the States, but in China, it happens all the time. In Indonesia, it happens all the time. It's not barred by the local rules. In other places, you have very, very activist judges who will actually conduct their own investigation. And it's not an adversarial type process. It's more like the German system, where the judge almost acts like an arbitrator or mediator, but he also has investigative powers. In other places, very, very similar to common law, like we're used to in most places in the States, where, you know, you have precedent, you have, you know, precedential cases, you have non-precedential cases, things like that. But in other places, it's not. One thing also, in Asia, there's almost no juries. for any type of litigation. Sometimes for criminal, they will have juries, but basically assume that they won't have any jurisdiction, which means you're talking to the judge. You're not talking to, a group of 9 or 10 or 12 people, laymen, right? You're talking to someone who's probably an expert in that area of law. And so you need to understand that. You need to understand who you're talking to. You need to understand the differences in local practice are. Oftentimes, I put down there specifically discovery. Basically, in Asia, you have no discovery. So you have to have all the evidence you need to win your case at the time you file your case. Very, very little chance that you'll actually be able to find out information or go on a fishing trip, fishing expedition to try to find more evidence later on. So that means that the pre-filing investigation can be extremely important. You know, I mean, literally, you have to have all the elements you need to win your case. You have to have all the proof and everything at the time you file. So you may spend 6-8 months gathering information, gathering evidence before you even file the case, or before you even, you know, send a warning letter to the other side. Because if you send a warning letter, they may just disappear or something like that. Some countries, some practices will allow you to have limited interrogatories. So you can send a list of like 5, 10, 20 questions to the other side. And they, in many cases, they should answer those. But in some cases, they can say, no, we don't answer because that's trade secret. And the trade secret may trump the interrogatory request so that they don't have to answer because they say, oh, it's trade secret. Is it really a trade secret, or they just want to not answer and claim it's a trade secret? I don't know. But it happens. So again, you need to think about this. Think about the difference in practices, legal, you know, evidence practices, evidentiary practices, as well as local court practices. Invalidity procedures happen in different places. Some places, some countries allow you to do invalidity in the court as a defense to patent infringement. Other ones, you cannot. You only can try to invalidate a patent or trademark or something inside of the patent or trademark office. So you need to understand that. One very, very prominent case in China for infringement, the defendant was a foreign company, plaintiff was a Chinese company, and they tried to invalidate the patent inside the court proceeding. The only place you can do it was inside the patent office. They had lost their chance to file it, and regardless of the evidence of invalidity, the court said, we're not even going to look at it because this is the wrong venue. You need to file that in the patent office. You didn't. Therefore, you know, default judgment for the plaintiff because they had no non-infringement argument because it was literally their own. I mean, the background of the story was that they had actually worked with this company as a vendor and as a supplier. The vendor and supplier then filed a utility model for the exact thing that they were making, of course. So yes, it definitely covered it. And then when the foreign company wanted to switch to another supplier, they said basically, no, you can't switch because we've got a patent for this, a utility model for this, and if you do, we're going to sue you. They switched. The Chinese company sued them, and the foreign company lost. There's no question about it. So, again, you need to understand these details. You need to understand what's proper, not assume that everything happens the same way in your own as it does in your own country, and make sure that you actually, you know, do things at the right time in the right place. Alternative to ADR. ADR is something which is growing in Asia. There's a huge amount of litigation in Asia, contrary to what you may believe, but oftentimes it may not actually be because there's a legal dispute going on. It may be because they want to get leverage for some other business dispute. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the China section. But if you are writing a license agreement or you're trying to solve an issue, I'd highly suggest if you take a look at ADR, there's a WIPO arbitration center in Singapore, there's CTAC in China, Japanese and Korean companies are very used to ADR. They'd much rather go through ADR than go through a public trial. So definitely take a look at it. And the best thing about ADR is that it can be kept secret, whereas a trial oftentimes may not be. And then going back to, you know, something we talked about earlier, please, please, please rely on your local expertise, your local IP attorneys, because they understand the local practice. And if you get someone who's used to working with foreigners, they'll know what the big watchouts are for you.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master. Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master.
Okay. Moving on to slide 13. For anti-counterfeiting tips, I think companies and attorneys need to think about, we need to be more commercial. Traditionally, we have not been very, very commercially focused. We now are reaching a stage where I think worldwide we need to understand where the business is coming from. And it comes down to money, really. You know, how are you going to make your money, and how are your competitors going to make money by copying your stuff, right? It sounds basic, it sounds silly, but I know a lot of people who don't even think about to ask these questions, you know. And wherever you're going to make your money, those are your crown jewels, and that's what you want to spend your money to protect. There's certain strategies when you're manufacturing something where you try to specifically make it more difficult for someone to copy or reverse engineer your product, right? Supply chain is a very easy place for people to insert themselves and find out all the technical details of your product. If they can be in your supply chain, they can pretty much make your product. So you need to think about it from a very paranoid point of view. You know, if I was on the other side and I really wanted to copy my client's product, what would I do? How would I get in there? What people in the supply chain have access to the right information, right? There's what we call the Coca-Cola model. You know, basically Coca-Cola, they make a very, very concentrated sweet syrup. They ship it all over the world to various distributors who then add 99.9% fizzy water, bottle it, and ship it, right? They do all the printing, the shipping, and the bottling, and the dilution. But what's in that, you know, that magic syrup that Coca-Cola makes is really where all of their IP is. And it's very, very difficult to, you know, run that through a mass spec and try to reverse engineer it. So that's something where, you know, if you can make all the secret sauce in your own factory and then ship it all over the world and then people dilute it with standard, you know, everyday types of ingredients, that's great. There's the black box. Basically, you have a bunch of dispersed suppliers, but you do all the final assembly in-house, right? Way, you know, none of your suppliers know all the other different suppliers. They don't know how everything is finally put together in the product or combined or whatever reaction are done to make the final product. That allows you to have control over those, you know, secret processes or secret vendors or whatever. And by having the final assembly or the final reactions or the final processing in-house, you have more control over it. That being said, oftentimes the biggest leakage occurs from people's own employees, right? So going to the next point, I know a lot of people, a lot of companies who inside their factories, their computers, their special order computers from, you know, Dell or HP or whoever, which have no USB ports. They have no wireless capability. They have no USB ports. So that's very, very difficult for someone, you know, no disk drives, of course, so that it's very difficult for someone to then copy all their manufacturing specs and the manufacturing process and then take it home with them on a USB stick or on a disk. Controlling your molds, if you are a company whose products are created from molds, or the packaging is created from molds or whatever, make sure that you control your molds. Make sure that any, you know, prototyping molds or whatever are given back to you and you destroy them. Don't take it for granted that your supplier is taking care of it for you. They may be getting rid of them, but their idea of getting rid of them may be to sell it to their friend down the street. And suddenly you see some products that look exactly the same as your product appearing on the marketplace. There's all these different types of strategies used to actually minimize the chance of counterfeiting. Honestly, I think if someone really wants to counterfeit your product, they probably will do it. So you're never going to be able to make it impossible to counterfeit your product. What you can do, and what I've seen done and had good success doing, is actually making it so difficult for them to counterfeit your product that they go and copy someone else's product. They're going to copy something anyways. Just make it so much of a pain in the ass that they won't copy yours, they'll copy someone else's. And I've seen that work, you know, multiple times. I used to go to trade shows, and, you know, the first couple times I went to the trade show, they'd be like, wow, you guys have never come to the trade show before. We've copied your product for 10 years. You never came. Like, well, we're coming now. And then after the next time, you know, they're like, wow, you're still coming. I'm like, yes, we're still coming. Third, fourth time, you know, as soon as I walk up to the booth, they're like, don't worry, we're not copying your product. You know, take a look around, look at anything you want. We're not doing it. We're copying someone else's product, so don't worry about it. Fine. That's for me, for my client, that's considered a win. Moving on to China, if you look at slide 14, there's two quotes there which I'd like you to take a look at. One is, it's not as bad as you've heard. The second one is, it's just as bad as you've heard. And I'll tell you right now, both of those statements are true. Now, how do we reconcile that? I think there is this misconception in the West that China is one country. Politically, you know, I know I'm stepping into a minefield here, but politically, you may think so. Economically and culturally, it is not one country. I know companies that divide up China into three different tiers. Tier one is the top three cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou. Tier two is the other cities that are over 10 million people, right? Chongqing, you know, Xi'an, all these other places. Tier three is basically everywhere outside those big cities. I would say even that is not detailed enough. I'd say if you really want to do it right, you'd probably divide up China into 10 or 12 different levels. Because, you know, even though Chongqing has 33 million people, it's not the same as Beijing or Shanghai, right? Xi'an is, you know, population-wise is huge, but it really doesn't have the same type of sophistication and consumers that you would see as people on the East Coast. Nanjing is, you know, very, very close to Shanghai, you know, only, 40 miles away, 60 miles away, but the people in Nanjing, you know, or Ningbo are completely different from the people in Shanghai, right? So again, you really, really need to think about these actual differences, right? Between the cities, the villages, the, you know, mega cities, and everything in between. And because of that, there's socioeconomic differences, there's political differences, there's, you know, supply differences, there's educational differences, all these different things which make it as if China is not one country, but it's, you know, 12 different countries or something like that. So, and what I said here is that it's not as bad as you've heard. And I'm talking about things like intellectual property disputes. We're talking about, you know, legal issues and things like that. And if you have an infringement case that you're filing in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou. You know, these three cities have specialist IP courts. Your chances of winning your litigation and your predictability of the litigation are going to be about as good as anywhere else in the world. Right? Litigation is inherently unpredictable, but your chances of getting a decent judgment, your chances of getting a well-reasoned judgment, you may not agree with it, but the outcome, but at least will be well-reasoned, it's as good in these three cities as it is anywhere else in the world, in, you know, Washington, D.C., or, you know, in California, or in London. But if you are just 3-4 hours west of Shanghai, or if you are, you know, 2 hours north of Guangzhou, and you're filing the exact same lawsuit on the exact same facts, good luck. As I tell people, you know, flip a coin, I'll tell you whether you're going to win or lose. And that's simply because, you know, you don't know if that company that you're suing or you're trying to enforce against is the largest taxpayer in the entire province or the largest employer in that area. And, you know, you may find that the factory owner is the brother of the mayor, and he's having dinner with the chief of police, you know, 3 times a week. If you try to imagine, you know, for those of you, this shows you how old I am, so for those of you who remember the Dukes of Hazzard, if you are, like, trying to enforce a patent against Boss Hogg, good luck, right? But in the big cities, you can get a decent judgment, you know, that's on the facts, not based on political considerations or not based on, you know, bribery and things like that. The question is, how do you get venue in those big cities? And it's something which can be done. You know, local attorneys will show you, will tell you, oh, if you want to, you know, enforce against this company, you don't want to enforce where they're manufacturing, where they're the largest employer in the city. You want to enforce against their marketing office in Shanghai. Or you want to enforce it against their, you want to do a trap purchase in Beijing and have a notary purchase it and have it delivered to that notary in Beijing. You have a notarized purchase in Beijing. You now have venue in Beijing to then sue them. Or you want to, you know, do something like that, do their marketing office, do their sales office, which is in the big cities, or do some other type of thing so that you can get venue in those cities. So you can then get a decent judgment. If not, you're just taking your chances. You're, you know, good luck. Maybe you can get a good judgment, maybe not. Maybe you can get a better judgment on appeal. But in China, you only have one guaranteed appeal. After that, maybe. Right? If the court decides to take your appeal, they can take your appeal. It's like a writ of certiorari. You know, but they don't have to. So again, you need to really pick your venue well. So in China, the IP systems are basically fine. Within the limitations of their own rules, the IP systems are fine. The legal system is undergoing flux right now. You know, it's getting better, but it's a huge culture change and it takes time. So, and again, with a country as large as China, it doesn't go quickly. But, you know, things are getting better, but they're not perfect yet, and they won't be for a long time. But so that's what I say when I say it's not as bad as you've heard, and at the same time, it's just as bad as you've heard. Okay. Again, moving on, I think this is stuff that we've talked a little bit about before already. In China, throughout most of Asia, really, file your trademarks, your patents, your unique designs as early as you can. It's something where, you know, if you're second, you know, first to file jurisdiction, you know, you're just paddling upstream the whole way. Good luck. Contracts, make sure that your supplier, your contractor is someone who, you know, understands the contract, who really can be relied upon. You know, and down there in the bottom, do your due diligence. You know, if I know people who spend, you know, 6 months doing due diligence in the U.S., before they sit down with someone and talk with them about doing a deal. And yet when they come to China to do a deal, they feel they have to have everything signed at the end of the week when they're going home, because they want to be home on Saturday to, you know, wake up the children. if you're going to spend 6 months doing due diligence in the U.S. or Europe, why wouldn't you spend at least the same amount of time doing due diligence in China, where you don't know what's going on? It's a mystery to me. But, you know, I know some incredibly brilliant, smart people who are wonderful business people, and then they come out to Asia and they do stupid things. So just really, you know, don't skimp on the details. You know, don't skimp on the due diligence. You know, it'll save you so much hassle later on. And just make informed decisions, really. Understand, you know, leverage the local expertise. Understand when things are going to be the same as back home and when things are going to really be different. Don't assume that everything will be the same as it is in the U.S. because some of it may sound the same. They may even use the same words, but they actually mean something completely different by that. So that's pretty much it. I think we've covered all the main topics that I had. If you look on the next page, there's my contact information. If you do have any questions, please go ahead, drop me a line. You know, I've been in Asia a really long time. I've seen a lot of weird stuff happen. You know, hopefully this has been helpful and you can, you know, avoid some of the problems that I've had and advise your clients a little bit better than maybe I have done in the past. But, you know, it's all a journey. You know, we're all learning all the time. So if you have any questions at any time, just drop me an email. All right. Thank you very much. And this is Michael Lynn.